Hello, my name is Raj Mehta, and I'm here with Richard Lehman on Richard Lehman Discusses EBM. How are you today, Richard?
I'm fine, thank you, Raj. But today I think you're going to discuss EBM and I'm going to chip in. We need to make this more equal. I feel slightly embarrassed about this title. Anyway.
I love listening to you talk so much, though, Richard. I think it's a great title. Yes, today we're going to be speaking a little bit more on the topic of diagnosis, and specifically diagnosis from the perspective of family pr practitioners, GPs, in a primary care setting. And I'm going to offer us an outline to kind of walk through the structure of kind of the basics of filling out this process of diagnosis. And then hopefully together, Richard and I will also provide examples to kind of clarify what we mean. And I'll begin with perhaps the most important question, which is, what is diagnosis? So when I think of diagnosis, to me, it is the act of labeling an individual, a person with a specific disease, illness, or syndrome that I suspect or I think that they have. That usually requires me to fill some minimal criteria. There's usually diagnostic criteria, whether it's in a probabilistic sense or if it's strict defined rules. So you need to have this many symptoms, this many points of so and so findings, and so forth.
That certainly is the theory, and sometimes it's very easy, and sometimes it's very hard. Sometimes it's very concrete, sometimes it's very woolly. And we as GPs have to work in the context of medicine as we find it in our day. Diagnosis has changed enormously over the centuries, and for until the last 250 years at least, it was based on the doctor knowing the theory of diagnosis, and therefore everything had to fit into a pattern of cold or hot, wet or dry, four humors, all sorts of things that mean absolutely nothing to us these days. But they were everything in those days because they allowed the doctor to pigeonhole the patient. That means put him in a slot, put her in a slot, and then pronounce authoritatively what needed to be done. Now, all that was complete rubbish, killed people, and it was a highly intellectualized process, similar to evidence-based medicine, but with the exact opposite result. The patient almost always got the wrong treatment. Now, we're looking at diagnosis after 250 years of scientific thought about it, and therefore we should be an awful lot better at treating our patients than they were and we are. However, we're still faced with big areas where diagnosis is a process of putting a tag on people. And the tag not really meaning a great deal to that individual. And that's the worst part of evidence-based medicine. The best part of evidence-based medicine is where we have a very clear idea of the cause of a condition and its treatment. And all these labels are what I would call consequential. They're consequential for the treatment we give and for the way that the patient regards themselves forever after. If we give a patient the label of irritable bowel syndrome, that patient then goes away and looks up irritable bowel syndrome. If we give them a label of chronic obstructive airways disease, they go away with some inhalers in a bag and think of themselves as a person with respiratory disease. We haven't actually quite identified what that disease is. So labels can do all sorts of different things. And we need to look at them as we go along with concrete examples, as we had last time, and also with less concrete examples. That's my initial statement on the subject, if that's all right, Raj.
I love that historical perspective because I think when we think of diagnosis in the EBM era, the key promise we have is that it is evidence-based, meaning the diagnostic labels and criteria we're creating, they have to be reproducible, they have to be reliable, but that they have to be based on something where the therapeutic management or the prognosis that we derive from that has some consistency and some validity. And that's that data and that sense that it comes from something that is of scientific process and value is so important, because otherwise we can end up in this situation where we create very intellectual, logical games and categories that don't actually have any value to patients or to our ability to care for them. And I think it's also really important to note here that, you know, diagnosis is not about us having a sense of self-satisfaction that we're putting a label on somebody. It's about us offering patients something that allows to have consequence, whether it's therapeutic options now that we understand what is happening and perhaps can help make them better. In the absence of therapeutics, at least a prognosis that this is what you can expect given this constellation of symptoms and illness you have. And that's very, very important. And I'm always hesitant to just go about offering labels that can sometimes create a sense of stigma if there's nothing consequential we can do with that.
Yeah, I think there has been this debate about overdiagnosis and the harms that could come from giving patients labels. On the other hand, great benefit can come to patients from having a label which allows them to identify with a wider group of people suffering from the same condition, even if you can't really treat it very well. At least it's a known thing. They're not alone in the dark with their suffering, or their symptoms, or their lack of understanding of what's happening to them. There is at least some understanding of the condition. There is still at least a recognition that it exists. And there is hopefully a research agenda attached to that label. So let's not dislabeling altogether, but let's now look how it applies in real life. And of course, most of what we're talking about in primary care is a fairly simple process. I'll come on to this in a moment when I discuss a paper that describes the various processes that GPs in England went through 15 years ago. But before that, I'll hand back to you, Raj, for the next set of observations.
Well, I think you brought up two important points here, which is we've discussed the what of diagnosis. The next thing to note is the who is making the diagnosis. So certainly we as physicians are offering these labels, but patients themselves will often come to us with symptoms of illness and have a diagnosis itself. Or sometimes we have to then translate those illness symptoms into a diagnosis. And that can be very important because we are then validating that illness that they're suffering from or the symptoms they have. Even if we're not 100% sure what that may be, it's a very important part of that process. So distinguishing the who in addition to the what. And then the third point of that is the when. When do we make that diagnosis? And sometimes we may not have a clear picture when we first see a patient in a primary care setting, and it may take us time to kind of create a sense of certainty about what is happening. And having a longitudinal relationship with patients, the ability to know them over time and to try and figure this out together in a partnership can be very important as well.
That's a fantastic segue to the next points that I was going to make, which arise from this paper that I mentioned. And you have touched upon this very important aspect of trust building, of a patient coming primed with their own ideas of what's happening, us working with those ideas, and a shared understanding emerging. Now, shared understanding, of course, is a label that I attached to myself when diagnosing my position as professor for 3 years. I had to give myself a label, and I didn't want it to be shared decision making, because understanding has to precede and follow from decision making. So thanks for making those points. Now, the self-labeling issue is one of the things that wasn't very prominent until this paper appeared in the BMJ in 2009, and it was the chief investigator, because it was actually an investigational study, mm-hmm. Was Carl Hennigan in Oxford. And Carl was observing himself and his patients initially. That was phase one. And then he took it out to a wider group of primary care physicians to see if the same things were happening in their practices was happening in his. And this is a great paper, and I'm not sure how well it's been followed up, but it describes the process of diagnosis as it actually happens in British primary care in the opening decade of this century. Things may have moved on, but they'll have moved on more in the direction of self-labeling, I suspect, than was the case 15 years ago, because people do look up things routinely on the web. This used to be very much discouraged in the days when I first learned medicine. You know, a patient thinks they know what's wrong with them. Well, why do you come to see me then? You know, was the authority figure. Nowadays, I hope we all welcome patient suggestions as to what they are worried about, because those are the things that we have to address in order to build trust. And as I said, work towards a diagnosis as a shared process. And this brings us into a realm that seems quite remote from evidence-based medicine in a way. And I'm glad we're there, because if anything, these chats we have together are to try and reveal ground that isn't well covered in the conventional literature. And if we think about the EBM literature of diagnosis, it is, as we said, all about 2x2 tables and predictive value of tests. There is also a great deal of predictive value in context and the degree of uncertainty and anxiety in the room. But before I go on to this Hennigan paper, let's hear from Raj again.
I think you bring up a couple excellent points, which is, one is that, as excellent as EBM has been in giving us a transparent way to have, you know, discrete calibrated ways of describing test sensitivity and specificity and so on, the art of diagnosis sometimes involves a lot more uncertainty that's difficult to measure and can be lost a little bit in the literature. One such example is the sense of where the patient is in that room when you're sitting with them, their well-being, how well they're engaging with you, how you can pull information for them, and how time and developing that relationship of trust is so important and integral to making these kinds of happen. And it's worth pointing out here that diagnosis and this process changes depending on where you are in the setting. For us, in a primary care setting, in an office, is very different than an emergency room physician, is very different than a surgeon on the OR table or a hospitalist. And the acuity and the severity and the urgency and the ability to get rapid tests can change this process a lot. But for us, at least, there are a lot more external factors that can come into this and that requires a little bit of nuance to interpret and to go through. And I think that is going to lend itself to the next thing we're going to be discussing. And perhaps one of the more interesting and philosophical aspects of diagnosis is how we as physicians actually make a diagnosis. How do we go through this process? And it's a funny thing that we all do this, and sometimes I'm not really even sure how I do it. It's actually nice to review academic papers that present examples and models. You know, who knows what really happens in the mind? But, you know, some of these models, I think, do a reasonable job of capturing how I perceive myself and others going through the diagnostic process.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is exactly where I was going next. The British primary care system filters everything that happens to people, except for accidents and sexually transmitted diseases, basically. And it has built up an expertise on examining what we call the consultation, which is a term that's not that much used in the States. The consultation, of course, is where the patient meets the doctor and the doctor acts out his part, her part, in 10 minutes in the British system. And we're used to videotaping these things, we call it video. Of course, it's not actually on a tape any longer, but videoed consultations have been a part of examination and teaching in the UK for ages, whereas that's less so in the States, I believe. Anyway, cultural differences apart, what happens, I suspect, is much the same. And the consultation is analysed often for the quality of the interaction between the patient and the doctor. But Hennigan was the first, or among the first, to look specifically at diagnosis. And he looked at 100 of his own consultations on video and discovered that there were certain routine features of making diagnosis to patients who walked through the doors of English practitioners. And these divided initially into basically three processes. First of all, as we said, the patient will come and say, "Doctor, I think I've got XYZ," self-labeling. The second was that the doctor would instantly recognize what the patient was likely to have. This might be a rash, or might be a particular kind of cough, or they might be deeply cyanosed, or whatever. That deeply cyanosed patients didn't usually rock up in our surgeries, but depressed patients would, and they would have a particular demeanor and a particular way of expressing themselves we thought we could recognize. And then only third down the list was a presenting complaint that was an intellectual challenge to the doctor directly to apply logical thinking to. And that's, of course, the situation that we're taught in medical school most. So those are the first things. A spot diagnosis is easy. Pattern recognition can be easy, or might need another stage or two. Let the patient explain, the pattern would emerge. Yes, that's quite clear. And it can go on to a physical examination. As I said, a rash can be very easy to identify, provided you get the patient to take their clothes off, which some practitioners have great difficulty doing sometimes, persuading themselves that it's necessary. And this is why a lot of us were very skeptical about video consultations from afar, or telephone consultations. Couldn't actually see the patient. Those are all part of the context in which we make these sort of stepwise decisions. Anyway, I've talked enough about that initial stage. Back to you, Raj, to take it from there, and we can go on and talk about the next stage or whatever you like.
Yeah, no, this is a perfect encapsulation. There's different ways to model and discuss the way diagnosis happens, but this perhaps two most common frames we have are the spot diagnosis and then the way we traditionally teach, which is a more intellectual step-based approach. And especially for students, when you see an experienced clinician seemingly walk into a room, ask a few questions, do a brief examination, then out of thin air, kind of figure out exactly what's going on. It almost seems a magical, you know, process, you know, almost Sherlock Holmesian in a way. And it's quite incredible how adept we can get at this and do this so quickly. And if you were to ask me, like, how do I do that in the moment, assuming I'm not making errors and getting correctly, I honestly wouldn't be able to tell you, other than just a lot of pattern recognition and repetition exposure over time. And, you know, a lot of context based on cultural clues and patient factors and so on. And it's kind of the core of how we practice, because one, we get better at it when we know our patients well. So it speaks to the value of primary care and this longitudinal relationship. But two, it allows us to just be efficient. And that's such an important part of primary care, because we may have 10, 15 minutes max with the patient, maybe 20 if we're lucky, and they may have 3 or 4 or 5 problems, and kind of efficiently getting through these, figuring out what it is, and giving ourselves more time to then discuss important aspects like what the patient has to do, explaining them to the disease, therapeutics management, et cetera, is really, really critical. So it's an essential skill to master, and a transition I hope that all clinicians experience can get to if they want to be efficient.
Yeah, and I think we're probably going to fill most of this podcast without even talking about lab tests, which of course are that we tend to immediately leap to when we talk about diagnosis. We're talking about the whole frame in which we start thinking, and that's an emotional frame as well as a cognitive frame in other ways. The degree of tension in the room, the degree of anxiety that the patient has, the fervency with which they seem to be emphasizing certain features of what they're experiencing. All these are very important things. And they're a far distant thing from working out the sensitivity and specificity of a particular urine test or whatever it might be, that we will come on to eventually, but probably not this episode.
And one of the things that makes this work for experienced clinicians is, one, I think many of us have algorithms or heuristics of how to interpret common presenting complaints or concerns. And so patients will describe having a chief concern, which is the most important thing. But the second aspect of this is sometimes just translating the patient's experience to our clinical model's understanding. Because a lot of times patients themselves may not be aware which symptom they have or which physical finding or subjective experience is actually most discerning to us. And so being able to talk to them, and they're anxious about what they think is symptom A, but being able to tease out that it's really B, C, or D that's really critical to understanding what's going on, and helping them translate those subjective experiences into something that's a little bit more objective or contextualized, that helps us kind of get into that core of that diagnosis.
Yeah, and bear in mind that what we're talking about is not wooliness and fuzzy thinking or touchy-feely stuff. It's actually very much part of the process of getting a diagnosis that's consequential for the patient. We're not avoiding the science of medicine here. We're just putting it in its place and putting us in our place amongst it. And that, I think, needs emphasizing as one of the deficiencies of EBM as simply something you read and you do figures.
Absolutely. I mean, you can only use the data you have for EBM. So if we haven't done a good job discerning from patient and collecting that and putting it together, then we'll miss out on key points that can affect our final impressions.
Yes. Continuity of care is important in this. Observational studies have their limitations, but all those that have been done which compare discontinuous and continuous care favor continuous care, both in patient outcomes and even in mortality. So I'll just throw that in while we're talking about this stuff, in case you think we're wandering and praising ourselves too much. Too much importance to primary care. It really is a very important thing. Primary care isn't just a gateway to secondary care. It's not a sort of falling off the ladder career option that, you know, anyone can do. It really is, I would say, a very important, difficult intellectual discipline when carried out properly. Anyway, that's enough of that. Let's move on to the more quantifiable stuff that may take place next. I'll go back to Hennigan's paper and now describe how he classifies the iterative side of the diagnostic process, where we get into a proper conversation with the patient. We start thinking about possibilities, but we haven't yet examined the patient. And I'll give you a list of four, and I hope you can concentrate sufficiently to keep these in your mind, because I find them quite difficult to distinguish from each other. But the ones he's put down are restricted rule outs, i.e., get the most important things out of the way before you go on to anything. If there are any red flag aspects of a patient's history, make sure that you cover those and that you're quite sure that this sudden headache is not a subarachnoid hemorrhage. This abdominal bloating is really just bloating. It's not a fullness that it indicates ascites due to cancer, et cetera, et cetera. Restricted rule outs. He actually distinguishes those from clinical prediction rules. like the Otto Rankel rules of eliminating fraction and so on. But I think the two very much overlap. And probably older generation doctors like me don't use clinical prediction rules as such. We've got a kind of internalized rule book in our brains. We flatter ourselves anyway that we do. However, if the diagnosis is genuinely difficult, then we have to start a stepwise process, and we have to give ourselves enough time. And it may be time within that consultation period, or be time for another consultation, to do the stepwise refinement of our diagnosis. And then as a separate category, again, he says probabilistic reasoning, but I think stepwise refinement is probabilistic reasoning in my book anyway. And here we can start talking about Bayes' rule, how likely are in a list of diagnoses is the one that we're thinking of. And we can attach a kind of numerical value to that. But actually, it's probably best to stay in a somewhat hazy probabilistic relation to what we're thinking until we can actually do some measurements and do some sorting out. Anyway, that's my next step. And once again, Raj, I'd be interested in your views about that and where we go next.
Well, I remember being a student, being always fascinated, like, what is this mysterious process of how we do this evidence-based stepwise approach to diagnosis? And it almost surprised me how simple it is, because it's the most basic form of scientific approach. We have a bunch of data or information. This can be a collection of signs, symptoms, physical exam findings, laboratory data, etc. And then we just come up with a list of competing hypotheses that's compatible with all that information. Mm. And then once we have that competing list, we kind of go through a stepwise process to say what is more or less likely. And it's very interesting because there's different ways you can create a list of hypotheses given that information. You can take the restricted rule out, which is basically saying prioritize that list of hypotheses based on what's the thing we cannot miss, because it's so important and it's high risk and there are red flags. And if we miss this, it can be really bad for the patient. That's one way of doing it. You can do it based on epidemiology, like what's most likely based on age profile, gender, areas you're in, et cetera. You can do it based on what you think is most clinically likely based on the clinical symptoms that are there, and clinical prediction tools can be helpful here. And then you can use textbooks and so forth. And then once you have that list, you know, then we start getting into this assessment of assigning probabilistic values to them, then using probability to try and update which we think is more or less likely. And I think it's one important thing to state here is that we're doing this in our mind as physicians, but we're not always strict about how we're ascertaining probabilities. We don't necessarily have a number in our head, or we're saying this or that. It's more of an intuitive process. When we're forced to write it down, say, and explain to somebody else, I might formally go through and assign numbers and update them based on test sensitivity and specificity, but that's not necessarily day-to-day how we're doing it. And there's great value in using the probabilistic model to assign probability values and talk about Bayes' rule and how we're updating information, because that does allow us to explain it to others. But you know, we also have to be careful, because using probability as a model has certain limitations. We're assuming that, you know, everything adds up to 100%, that the rules and numbers we're assigning are fixed, that there's no new information coming in. And the actual process of how we mentally think about it is a little bit more fuzzy. Sometimes we have new information, we update how likely we think something in or isn't. And it doesn't always follow probabilistic rules perfectly. So useful for describing how we do diagnosis, a very clear model is very, very important. But I don't want students to get too caught up that things have to be perfectly probabilistic or follow math rules perfectly, because it doesn't always. There are some variations there and nuances we have to be aware of.
Yes, absolutely. There is a difference between what we do consciously as an explicit activity. And some have described that almost as a rehearsal for the real thing. In real life, you work at speed, and there is the famous distinction between type 1 and type 2 decision making or thinking. And this certainly applies to diagnosis. We could go home and work out for an hour how we came to a particular type of diagnosis, and we could teach that to students. But in real life, they could, most of their learning is through apprenticeship, through seeing us doing it in front of a patient who is examining us, by the way. We're not just examining them, they're examining us for signs of doubt, for signs of concern, for the tone of our voice, the way we contact their eyes contact ours, etc. Anyway, having said that, we now move on to Hennigan's third stage of the consultation. And this is where the diagnosis is made, that's nice and easy, or has to be made by some other process in the fullness of time. I'm sorry to keep talking about process, by the way, that's just the way that English people say process, but it hasn't always been that way. Anyway. So fine, you've got your diagnosis one way or another, the patient goes out hopefully happy, because if they're not happy with your diagnosis and you haven't checked that they're happy, then they'll see some other guy, or they'll they will lose trust in you. So, you know, that's just a basic point about finishing off any consultation.
It does.
However,
It holds a very subtle but important point here, which is that we have a threshold. You have a threshold, which is almost a line in a probability scale, saying when you pass this threshold, we're going to make that diagnosis. And we, as physicians, we can kind of have our own internal sense of where that threshold is. But as a group, we try to have some consistency so that you or I or anyone else might make that same diagnosis. And then we get into this interesting point of where do you set that threshold? You know, because if we set it too high, we may miss some people. But if you want to try and capture everyone and we set it too low, we might create some overdiagnosis. And that's especially when we start talking about population health, how we set that threshold from when do you say, okay, we've got enough to make the diagnosis, or perhaps we need more information, can be a subtle but important point. In reality, it's not something I actually worry about day to day, but philosophically, it's just something important to know about in a broader sense.
It can be something we worry about from day to day. You know, we learn from our mistakes, but patients suffer from our mistakes. So we're trying to strike a balance between taking their anxiety and their uncertainty away from them and still being safe doctors. And that's where we go on to the next three things that Hennigan mentions, and those are the tests. Now, we've talked about tests already, and we think of them as things where patients get blood drawn or go off and have some imaging, but that's not true. I mean, there are two other tests. One is the test of time. What happens next? Come back in 2 weeks, come back tomorrow. And then there is the test of treatment. I think you have such, and if I'm right, it will go away with this ointment, these tablets, or by twisting your arm in a particular way. Doesn't always have to be drugs. And then, of course, there are the lab tests, which divide, as I said, into imaging, roughly speaking, into imaging and blood tests. And then there is actually another category. And that is, I don't know. Are you happy just to leave things as they are? Because I know that it isn't the thing that you came in, you're worried about, but I can't actually explain why you've got low back pain, because most low back pain is not explicable. It's just something that happens. And I'm awfully sorry about that. And there are things that you can do, like keep active and take painkillers and so on. And there are plenty of people who will sell you their manipulative treatments and so on. But sorry, in terms of anatomy and physiology, I'm just not going to say that you've got anything than you told me when you came in and said you had low back pain. So those are the alternatives.
It is so important. It's one of the most important things. It's embracing the uncertainty and just having intellectual honesty. Because telling a patient, I don't know what's going on, is not saying I don't care about you. It's not saying I don't feel your symptoms or illness is real, because I do. I believe you're suffering. I believe this is real. I'm just being honest. I'm not 100% sure what it is. Maybe I think it's a couple of possible different things. Maybe I have no clue. And hopefully, if it's something self-limiting, we can still try different things and work together. Or if we need to do more things, we can do it. It's an area where you really end up having to discuss with the patient where they're at. But I think it's super important. And oftentimes, it's harder to do for us. It takes a little bit of letting go of our ego. It takes a little bit more time to walk the patients through it. But I think it's the right thing to do, and it's better for patients.
So we're running out of time, and I think we've covered an awful lot of ground, but very little of it has got to do with the kind of stuff that you'll read in EBM papers about diagnosis and the predictive value of tests. Because as we found, tests in the lab or in the imaging room are probably the great minority of what we do when we see in the UK, 90% of patients come to see us and don't go on to have any test or go on to be seen by a hospital doctor. The incentives in the NHS are completely the opposite of those in the US, where tests mean money, and in the UK, tests mean consumption of resources and long waits. And so we have slightly different attitudes towards the testing patients with those modalities. But at the same time, we're doing a grand intellectual job, I think, of reducing uncertainty, providing the right treatments and the right labels for patients in primary care. And I think every system badly needs that, or it becomes unwieldy and cost ineffective. So those are my little puffs for NHS general practice. And on that note, Raj, I'll let you finish.
I'll have to endorse everything you said, Richard. I could not agree more. And I think it's true for primary care in general. Anyone with interest in health economics, health utilization, you know, the aspects of primary care that allow us to try and deliver excellent care while minimizing unnecessary resources comes down to the things you've just mentioned. I do want to make a couple additional points, and I think this is an important way to cap off this discussion, which is avoiding common pitfalls and errors. Because as we discuss diagnosis, it's also important to admit that there are times when we are in error. And there are a few cognitive things that can come up. I'm going to just mention four of them. One, which is very common, is anchoring heuristic. So anchoring bias is when we're convinced it's one diagnosis and we exclude ourselves and close our mind off to others. And that's something that can become problematic, because as we mentioned, how experienced clinicians can just spot a diagnosis. When we do it well, it's fantastic. But if we're not cautious, we can jump to a conclusion, and the anchoring bias can close us off to new information that tells us our initial diagnosis is wrong. A second bias is availability bias or availability heuristic. And this is when we become biased by seeing the same types of problems or patients over and over. And we just assume that, you know, the next patient is going to have that, even though another diagnosis may be more likely. Third is framing effects. So this is when we become overly influenced by the context and we ignore the stronger predictive clues. So, you know, we are always putting together different pieces of information. It's important we prioritize the right factors and don't overwhelm, we look at the wrong things. And if we get too caught up on a lot of collateral and epidemiology data and we just forget the clinical picture in front of us, regardless of all that, we can kind of miss the signal and the noise. And then the final one, and this is perhaps the biggest criticism of EBM, is just blind obedience, being overly rule-focused, trying to follow algorithms too closely, putting undue reliance on tests and algorithms and ignoring some of those more subtle clues and nuances. And we have to be careful that, you know, we don't, you know, even if the test tells us the disease is negative, but we highly suspect it, just keep in mind that every test has a false negative, and, you know, to think more than just what the tests are telling us, what the rules are saying.
Yeah, well, Raj, you've got me on my hobby horse again. while the clever boys in Oxford, Henning and Glasher, etc., went on to do a five-part series in the BMJ on diagnosis in primary care, which is well worth digging out, I decided I would peel off and do my own series called Easily Missed. And this is, it's still going in a very vestigial form in the BMJ, but it reached, I think, 80 articles in the end of conditions that we as GPs need to be more aware of, so that it's all very well ending up reassuring the patient and thinking we're doing a fine job, but we do need to be very certain that we're not missing these conditions. And so they've been collected in a book, in fact, or three books, because there were so many of them. And it's a series I keep forgetting I did, to be honest, but it's probably my biggest contribution to the mess.
It must be good to be so accomplished, Richard, that you forget half the things that you've done that are so great.
But having said that, I must say it was entirely written by other people. It was only I helped choose the conditions and edit the products. But anyway, there it is. And thank you very much for staying on for quite a long conversation that we've been having together. And of course, we still want to have more conversations about diagnosis. So stay tuned.
Before we go, Richard, I want to give us an opportunity to have our final thoughts. So what is your summary or takeaway from today's discussion?
That I should probably talk less. that diagnosis is not simple and it's not numerical, though it sometimes can be numericized usefully. The EBM is great for those numerical aspects, but there is a huge amount of wisdom and accumulated knowledge that can be applied to doing diagnosis properly. And I'm by no means the best person to go into that, but there are superb people around. And maybe if we had a written article, I would be recommending a whole lot of books, but I won't do that.
Wonderful. And my takeaways are, you know, diagnosis is a rich history well before EBM, but I'm grateful for EBM to at least make some of these things transparent, data-based, and giving us some numbers in the textbook. Ultimately, though, diagnosis is a practiced art. You have to be in the clinic, in the wards, in different settings to learn this process, to see it happening. And there's a lot of cognitive tasks going on, so not to take it lightly, but to be aware of it and to always try to be improving upon it.
Again, amen.
Thank you, Richard. Until next time.
Bye.
Bye.